Happy New Year's, everybody. We have a great episode for you on this last day of 2025 with Mr. Graham Skipper talking about Book 4 of The Dark Tower, Wizard in Glass. But before we get to that, you know what's coming. Gotta do it one more time before the year ends on us. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to fangoria.com and sign up. And when you do, use the code KINKASS at checkout. Why don't you? You'll save 25% off of your subscription. That is fangoria.com, code KINKASS. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Go see a dead body.
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINKASS on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. Today we return to Midworld as we take another look at the fourth Dark Tower book, Wizard in Glass. Joining us in this journey, our temporary quartet, if you will, is one of the most reliable faces in genre today. He's a screenwriter, filmmaker, and actor who first turned heads as the lead in the Stuart Gordon-approved stage musical adaptation of Reanimator, where he played Dr. Herbert West himself. You've also seen him in Almost Human, Beyond the Gates, The Mind's Eye, Carnage Park, and very recently in Joe Lynch's Suitable Flesh. Everybody, please welcome Graham Skipper to the KINKASS. Welcome to the show, man.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, yeah. Did you do a little curtsy, a little cowboy curtsy?
I did. Oh, here, I gotta tap my neck three times.
Yeah, with the three digits and
three. Or is it my left hand? My left hand.
Yeah, that was hugely disrespectful what you just did.
It was. I'm very sorry. I apologize. I'll let that pass.
Well, I think we're gonna jump right into your Stephen King origin story because I really want to kind of lay the groundwork, lay the foundation of your Stephen King nerdiness before we get into, you know, the very niche. I can always tell when Dark Tower is the subject pick. You know, this isn't a casual fan, you know.
Well, but before we do that, Eric, can I derail things from the start?
right away. Okay, fine.
I'm just gonna throw a monkey wrench into it because Graham, I did not see your stage version of Reanimator. I'm dying to know, how did you do the scene? Or did you?
oh, we did. It was sung.
Where the Barbara Crampton character gets.
It's the greatest. It's a purely visual pun.
A head giving head.
Yep.
It's it was sung, and Jesse Merlin, who played Dr. Hill, he was sort of in a contraption where he was kind of sitting backwards, like Riker style, on an office chair. Mm-hmm. And he had like a, you know, the false front, which had the fake body holding his own head sticking through the chest. And then Rachel Avery was on her back on the gurney, legs facing upstage. And as he was singing and moving towards her, then I stepped in and of course stopped everything. And I sang at him. And then we did battle, and eventually Joe Bigas from beneath the stage tossed an intestine at me and then pulled me down on top of him. And that's how I met Joe. So it all came together in that moment.
Thank you for scratching that itch. I just had to know. So now we can proceed with Wizard in Glass.
Oh, it happened. Yeah.
It's totally fine. I was just racing right towards the meat, and you know, Anthony wanted an
appetizer. Let's not say that.
So was Dr. Hill in his own way. You know?
Yes.
And this is the quality content you get here at the KINKASS.
I mean, if you've ever, I mean, listen, at this point, people know what they're in for. So I'm happy to start on that note. And
I had to do something, you know, I'm filling in for Wampler and I'm not a wild card like him. So I got to throw something weird in here now and then. I just died. As soon as he said that, I'm like, man, how did that work? Thank you for answering my question.
I think what you need to do is every guest that we have on here before the Stephen King origin story, you just say, let's talk about the head giving head scene in Reanimator.
It is a good litmus test. We had lots of audience members that came on first dates.
Oh, no.
I always thought that was a great first date to come to. Just really, you know, see where you were at.
So to speak.
good lord, we're in the gutter and we're heading even further. All right,
this is a family program. Let's bring it back around.
Yeah, now let's talk about, you know, arranged marriages and evil riddle trains. All right, so
matricide, everything good is in this book.
Absolutely. So let's get your Stephen King origin story out of the way first, Graham, and then we'll jump into
It's a bit of a two-parter. When I was in elementary school, I want to say fourth or fifth grade, you know, I was reading Goosebumps. That's like where I was at. Big horror kid, but I was also a big scaredy cat, you know, so things were, Goosebumps was about as heavy as I could go. But I remember there was one kid in my class that he liked Stephen King, or at the very least, he knew who Stephen King was. And at one point, we had an assignment where we had to write to an author. That we really admired. I wrote to the author of Bunnicula, whose name I can't remember at the time, but they wrote back to me. But one kid wrote to Stephen King, and I remember it because we all had to bring in our letters back if we got them and read them to the class. And this kid, I remember, had asked Stephen King something to the effect of, how do you get all your scary ideas for your books? And Stephen King had
his favorite
back.
Question.
And Stephen King had written him back and had said, I can't remember obviously the exact words, but it was it
fuck you too, kid? Is this the famous exchange that's online?
It was I have the severed hand of a little boy about your age in a jar on my desk, and when I need a new idea, I pull the hand out and it starts to write me a new story. It was something like that. And I just remember thinking, wow, that's super creepy and that's great.
And that's how Stephen King came to be visited by Child Protection Services.
Yes. but then I would say my real, you know, I, again, as I continued to grow up and then went into middle school, I continued to be afraid of Stephen King. I mean, this was when people were, you know, kids my age were starting to listen to like Marilyn Manson and Metallica and like all those scary music and all that stuff. And I remember there was a group of kids that would carry around. They were like trading amongst them a copy of It. And they had taken the paper cover off of the hardcover. So it was just this black tome with It written on the side in red letters. And I was convinced like Satan was in those pages.
He was.
What's actually really funny, there is a connection to the King cast because one of those kids was a kid that I grew up going to school with, who is a friend of the show who goes online by the name Bakun. In real life, his name is Oliver, and Oliver and I grew up going to school together, and he was one of the kids that was carrying around It that so terrified me. I messaged him before I came on here, and I was like, I'm going to tell about how you used to scare the hell out of me as like a seventh grader walking around with It in your hands. But I kind of consider that my Stephen King origin story because it showed me that kids my age were reading Stephen King, and I was really interested, but I was really scared. I did not start with It. I actually started with The Gunslinger.
Interesting.
Great. I was over at my friend Tyler's house at a sleepover, and he was a big reader, and he and I were both big Lord of the Rings fans, and I saw him reading Wizard and Glass. And this was right after Wizard and Glass had come out. So that would have been, what, 96, 97, around there. And so I was like 13 or 14, and the cover looked like a fantasy book. And I was like, ooh, what's that? You know, I'd never heard of that. And then I saw Stephen King's name, and I said, oh, you read scary stuff. And he goes, well, it's not really horror. I wouldn't call it horror. You know, this is kind of fantasy. And that's what got me interested. And he explained kind of the general idea of the gunslinger of the Dark Tower. And he said, like, you could handle it. You know, it's got some scary stuff, but it's not pure horror.
Right.
And so, yeah, so I started with the gunslinger and immediately read, you know, Drawing of the Three really hooked me. And then the Wastelands was just like, oh, okay, this is exactly what I want. And then I got to Wizard and Glass, and as we'll talk about here, Wizard and Glass just it I mean, I was the same age basically as Roland is in that book, and it scratched all the fantasy itches that I had, but it really pushed my boundaries of like reading a grown-up book, you know. And then I had to wait like friggin', you know, 10 years before the next one came out, and I was in college. So that sucked.
Well, how do you think we felt, us olds? Because when I first read the series, they were up to book three, and so when I read Wastelands for the first time, it ends on that cliffhanger. They're on the psychotic train that is, you know, going to kill them and is racing them towards their destination, which just beyond their destination is the end of the line. And so you have the suicidal train that's gonna take these dudes with them, you know, this quartet you've grown to love, and you leave on this, like, let's begin this game of riddles. It's the only thing that they can do to preoccupy him while he's going is to challenge him to games of riddles. And I remember reading that as a kid, going, oh my God, and you're so hooked into the story at this point. You've just gone through the City of Lud. You've gone through like all this insane things. The group has been split up. They're back together. Everybody's doing their part. It's like a Star Wars movie that Wastelands is, right? And then you get to the very end, and I'm like, all right, let's get this battle of wits going. And it goes, and see you next time.
I know. Oh,
It's
just a
teased on the
nightmare.
cover too. The train is on the cover, and then you don't get to it till
Yeah,
the
you're
very end,
waiting
and
for
it's
the
like,
train the whole time.
sorry, kid.
And
Sorry,
yeah, so
kid.
how do you think we felt when it's definitely the biggest cliffhanger in the Dark Tower series, and it's and probably it I think it's probably the biggest cliffhanger in King's work, period. I mean, unless you count like Green Mile, because he's making you wait a month in between each segment. But yeah, so that was a rough period of time, because this is before like early announcements and stuff, and we didn't know when the fuck we were getting another Dark Tower book, and or if we were. And then, you know, and then Wizard and Glass gets announced, and you're just like, you know, there was a section of fandom that was you know, looking back on it, a little upset, because we'd waited all this time, and then, you know, the book is like 85% flashback, right?
Yeah, it's like, and wait some more while we tell a whole other story.
Yeah, but you do, it does pick up right where Wastelands left off
Yeah,
in
at
Lord of
least you get the
Wasteland.
end of the Blaine story before you get into all the Susan stuff. Yeah, I mean, that must have been awful. It must have been terrible. You know, it sort of reminds me of like I'm also a big Clive Barker fan, and like his Oberth series, I'm just dying for him to finish, and I don't know if that'll ever happen. So it must have felt a lot like that. I know that like when I finished reading Wizard and Glass, and I found out that, because my memory of it is that somehow we knew there were going to be seven books. Like somehow there was, I don't know if he had said it, or I don't know what that was, but somehow, because this was still in the nascent days of the internet, you know, like there I and if there were chat rooms about this, I certainly didn't know about them,
I
you
remember
know.
that too. There was a vibe of like, oh, we've got like four more chapters.
Yeah,
Maybe he
three
mentioned
more
it in an
chapters.
afterword or something to one of the books, or
Yeah,
something.
maybe. But I just remember, you know, because I'm also just a big completionist when it comes to these things, and I was so just like, oh my God, what's gonna happen? I if there was any disappointment for me in that whole series, it was probably when Wolves of the Kala came out, and that was just not what I was looking for in that moment, I think. But yeah, Wizard and Glass, just it's I was rereading it, and I didn't make it all the way, you know, through, obviously, since we've scheduled this, but it's just I feel like there's such a shift in terms of the like writing style between like Wastelands and this, where it just this feels so I don't know what that literary, you know, it feels very This book in particular feels so eloquent to me.
Yeah.
You know?
It's got that arcane language. It's from a different time, different era. It feels very medieval.
Yeah, it feels medieval, but it also had like I think of at least the voice I have in my head for like Rhea of the Coos, right? Of this like she sounds like a witch, but she also totally sounds like, somebody from a Clint Eastwood Western that, just some old haggard woman living in a cave. And it's that kind of I think that's part of what drew it to me is that more than any of the other books, this one felt like really a world, and you're really starting to get a glimpse of all the John Farson stuff, and then things start to get kind of weird with the meta stuff and Wizard of Oz and like and then with The Stand, like even because when did The Stand miniseries come out? I feel like that
94,
was
right?
it was before Wizard and Glass. So like I don't I didn't watch the whole The Stand miniseries, but like I knew who Randall Flagg was, probably from reading Fangoria or something. And so when you start getting those things, it just kind of, I don't know, it was something that just sort of blew my little mind of going like, oh, all this stuff is somehow interconnected. This is so wild to me.
Should we summarize for the constant readers who for whom Wizard and Glass may be decades in the past? So
Sure.
they deal with Blaine, the Mono. They get on this train that takes them through the wastelands, and they destroy him by basically fucking with his logic, right? He wants to engage them in a battle of wits, and they defeat the battle of wits by being as dumb as humanly possible.
But
Like
they
just
kill him with a dead baby joke. It's great.
right? It's like it's actually, I think, a genius way of dealing with some hyper intelligent artificial intelligence. Just
Well, and what struck me this time was it's sort of like Eddie's version of the end of It with the locking of the tongues,
right, for
like
sure.
it's sort of that. I don't know if that's intentional. I'm sure it is, but it's like Eddie finally really gets to step up and save the day and embrace his dumbass, shitty self, and he beats the bad guy. It's great.
It also reminded me of Who Framed Roger Rabbit and a different Eddie Valiant at
Oh
the end, carrying
yeah.
on and hopping around and being a clown and making the weasels laugh until they die. And I'm like, that's sort of a
Sure.
similar way of killing Blaine, right?
And can I also interject here that obviously this scene is a nod to Riddles in the Dark, it's the Bilbo and Gollum sequence, where they're the stakes are death and all this other stuff. But Stephen King outdoes Tolkien here. Tolkien pretty much copped out on that. Like I hate to be the one to
Take that,
shame this man.
professor.
This man who, created, a legacy that will outlive, me and my lineage. But
Now we're never going to get Tolkien on the show.
when you end your riddle contest by going, fuck it, what's in my pocket? What a cop out. At least Eddie here is just like, you know what? This schizophrenic, suicidal train AI thing just really fucking hates being hates illogic, and he like it's an actual like smart maneuver around this thing that can solve even the most difficult riddle that's heard everything, that's computed everything for centuries and decades. And even Roland, who we've come to find out, is just like, oh yeah, I was like a riddle champion, dudes. Check this out. Even he, can't save the day here. And it takes Eddie just being a fucking jackass from New York, to do it. So in this way, Stephen King outdid Tolkien, and I will stand by that.
You make a
Yeah, I
valid
agree.
argument. So then the gang, the Always Sunny gang, you got Susanna, Eddie, Jake, and or no, wait, we no, yeah, we got Jake,
Yeah,
right?
Jake's there.
And Roland, of course, they camp out.
And
Don't you
Oi, don't leave
and
Oi out.
Oi, the
The
Billy
mayor.
Bumbler. He's the Chewbacca, the mini Chewbacca of the gang. They're camping out near a thinny, and I love this part of the lore. I can't remember now. Was there a thinny? Doesn't he visit a thinny where there's like that demon lover that in was that the first book? Like starts to
Well,
blend together for me.
that's a
There's
summoning ring. I don't know that that's
summoning
a
ring.
I don't
Yeah,
know that
okay.
that's a thinny.
But
I
a
mean, maybe
thinny
it
was
is.
like,
I
I
don't
remember
know.
that being like, oh, interesting, like a thin spot between worlds. And correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but at this point, we're four books into the Dark Tower series. Nobody has any fucking clue what the Dark Tower is, even now. Even the characters don't know. They just need to know they have to get there, right? But the idea that it's this nexus of a multiverse, that's not yet introduced, is it?
Well, they Roland sort of explains it to them, and I know that they, because I believe in Drawing of the Three, don't they know about the Rose in New York?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow
Jake in particular
got called Jake to like it, right? kind of yeah. puts that together somehow, but I think that it's still kind of nebulous.
But yeah, I mean, Roland always described it as like, you know, the centerpiece of a wheel or whatever. And then, cause he describes the beams and all that stuff. And I think it's described really early on as the linchpin of all existence, right? This one structure is the thing holding everything together, right? So that, I think it's described that. I think Roland knows, but you're right in that none of the other quartet, like there's something that they know instinctively that they are in the right spot, that they're drawn to this, that they have to do this task, that they feel the call of protecting the tower. But you know, this is more of a quest where they're following Roland versus, you know, because it's his sworn duty.
It's much more close encounters, right? This means something. This is important, right? Rather than like knowing exactly why. That's my memory of it, because you have, as I'm trying to get back to that mindset of before we really understood the breadth of these stories, because I remember just thinking like, I want to get to the tower just so I can know what the fuck it is. Like I want to, that's got to be the reward, right?
Well, there's a great, sorry to interrupt you, there's a great part once they reach Topeka. I think it's Susanna that looks up and says, look, the beam's gone, because they had been following the beam, right? They've been saying, okay, well, the beam leads to the tower, so we're going to follow the beam. She looks up, says the beam's gone, and Roland says something like, well, in this win the tower might not physically exist. And they're all, and Eddie says some smart ass thing, you know, and he's like, well, like, we're going to get there and it's going to be nothing, you know? And Roland says, you know, basically like, well, but it's still there and we still have to protect it. So yeah, there is like this idea of, you know, you're thinking of this, and especially, you know, at the end of this book of Wizard and Glass, you know, like Roland sees the tower. We know that it is a physical structure, but it is this strange concept of it's also a metaphorical tower. It exists and it doesn't exist. And that's, I mean, think about how scary that is too for this group. Like the thing that our whole lives have been building towards, what if we get there? It's just an empty field. Like, what the fuck do you do? It's weird.
It's and we know there are other worlds than these. That's introduced in the first book. And, you know, there's our world. Then there's this, you know, mid world that seems vaguely like ours. They have the Beatles, but they also, it's like the Old West, you know, and it's some post-apocalyptic thing. You've got mutants. And then I can't remember now if it's the end of if it's in this book or if it's at the end of the Wasteland, where they find a biplane that has crashed that has like a Nazi symbol on it.
I
remember thinking like, this is that
that's Wasteland. Yeah.
Wastelands. Yeah.
Cause that's introducing, what's it, the TikTok man or whatever.
The TikTok man. Yeah. The big bad of this story, theoretically.
Until Randall Flagg just pops up at the end going, all right, you fuck this one up. Now I'm going to take control. He pulls a Thanos. Yeah.
I remember thinking like, okay, we got these other worlds, but the notion that the tower is the gateway to all these worlds and that those worlds are other Stephen King stories, that was still not clear. Maybe that was still forming in Steve's mind as he was writing this, you know, I think he was discovering this story as he went along, which is why it changes. But Graham, you're right. It does feel like a big change. You get this sort of archaic language. You get a flashback to a time that doesn't feel like our world, doesn't even feel like the post-apocalyptic world. It's a whole other like fairy tale kingdom. So he merges spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood with Stephen King's kind of contemporary, you know, let's call it modern gothic or something, you know, taking this supernatural and putting it in familiar times. And then he says, "Oh, by the way, now I'm going to pile a fairy tale onto it. I'm going to pile King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table on top of this." And that is a flavor that works. Like, I really liked that. But then we get a huge flashback. Just to continue with our summary of this novel, like the big flashback, we find out about Roland as a young man, how he trained, his mother, her relationship to this sort of sorcerer who's manipulating their kingdom, and he has friends. He's not a loner. Do you want to pick it up from there, Graham?
Well,
What goes
yeah,
on
I
in this
mean, I
flashback?
well, yeah, I mean, you know, we learn that Roland confronts his father about her mother's about his mother's indiscretion, and the father sort of shatters Roland by saying, "I've known for, 3 years or something." And that makes Roland, that's, I mean, this whole series is all about remember the face of your father, and here's Roland going, "Oh my God, my father's a coward. My father, is a weakling, that sort of thing." So Roland's going into this really trying to find himself as a man and trying to understand his place in the world. Him and his friends get sent out to the Barony of Magus. Is that how you pronounce it? I just sort of
I think
pronounce
that's
it
how they do
specifically.
it in the audiobook, so
Okay,
I just go
yeah.
with it.
So they go out to Magus, which is this little like backwater town that has these big oil fields, under the guise of, we're being sent from the inner baronies to come out and check out, to check out your oil, like your oil reserves or something. Really, what they're there to do is to try and spy on John Farson's insurrection that's mounting, and to try to figure out if the folks in Magus are in on this. They think that he's using the oil to sort of like fuel his war machines, I think they say, which is very Mad Max,
It's also 2 years before the plot of The Phantom Menace. Oh, there's a trade dispute.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's a good point.
That we must investigate and get tied up in.
And of course, poor old Roland immediately meets sweet Susan Delgado, who is she's not exactly betrothed to the mayor, but she's going to be his concubine because the mayor's wife is old and supposedly barren, and I and also like not as good looking as once she was. So the mayor wants a hot young thing to impregnate. So Susan has been, the one to be promised to the mayor. She and Roland meet. She and Roland fall in love. The love story is beautiful. And so while Roland is trying to manage this group of young wannabe gunslinger, not wannabe is not the right word, but young,
Yeah, they've all
gunslingers in
earned their guns at this
training.
point, right?
Yeah, but they're young. They're all like 14 years old. He's trying to lead them to figure out this whole thing about John Farson, but he's also totally clouded by this love with Susan Delgado and losing his and her innocence to each other. And then eventually everything goes to shit, and there are these local guys led by oh, you'll have to remind me, Jonas, is that his name?
Yeah,
Yeah, Jonas. Yeah,
the big coffin hunters,
yeah, the big coffin hunters, and they're led by a failed gunslinger. He never graduated gunslinger school.
He got
They're
his
just,
GED.
yeah. He went to gunslinger community college.
Just as good.
And they've got an axe to grind with these three kids from the inner, these three rich kids from the inner baronies. And so they're trying to get rid of them and prove that, and along with the sheriff of Magus, who's like, "Well, we don't need these upstarts around." It turns out, in fact, yes, the mayor and the sheriff and everybody are working with John Farson. Long story short, Roland gets a hold of the Merlin's grapefruit, which is basically a palantir from Lord of the Rings. Also, just a crystal ball. And he manages to get a hold of it. He looks at it. It shows him the Dark Tower, shows him that he's going to go to the Dark Tower it completely consumes everything about his mind, his spirit, everything. That's his purpose in life now, is to get to the Dark Tower. And amongst all of this, Susan's betrayal of the mayor is uncovered. Roland's basically duped by the whole thing. He doesn't think she's in danger. And Susan is burned alive at the stake.
Oof.
And Roland is totally devastated.
And if that's not a big enough gut punch, there's it also this devastated Roland ends up going back home and accidentally, maybe kind of accidentally, maybe a little bit in there shooting his own mother. So
Shooting his own mother, and then eventually, all this leads to the death of all of his friends and all the gunslingers, and Roland's alone, and it's all fucking awful.
And Roland
Not
sits, kicks
yeah.
back at the campfire and sips on his coffee and squints and she's like, "Yep, so that's my story."
Anyway, we delivered
Anyway, it's so
the
funny you mentioned that because I have it in my notes that this novel is like it's like a novel length Indianapolis speech. From Jaws, this is where you understand why Roland is who he is. You've gotten a little backstory from Roland, especially in that first book. The Gunslinger does a lot of jumping into Roland's childhood, and then all that stuff's kind of left off the table until this book, right? You hear a little bit about Gilead. You hear a little bit of the lore and the backstory. But in terms of actually the reader experiencing a real deal flashback and being in Roland's young shoes, all that stuff is a big part of the very first book, The Gunslinger, and then just kind of set aside. And you're just in the moment from, Drawing of the Three as he's gathering his quartet, Wastelands, where, he's finally bringing Jake back into the fold and making up for, I guess, in a way, making up for murdering this poor kid
Sorry, I
in the
let you
first book. Yeah.
die.
It's like, but we fixed it now, right? Because a different version of
We
you is
good?
totally cool. And then there, the Wastelands is like the Empire Strikes Back of the series to me, because this is where the characters, they're gelled together. Like I said, they get split up, and then there's rescuing going on. All this while, the biggest bads of the universe are starting to appear on the chessboard, right? That's where Randall Flagg shows up. That's where this book is where the Crimson King is brought up. But yeah, this is really all about telling you who Roland is, why he is the way he is. And you understand it when he's done. You go, of course, if anybody had lived through this. And the way King writes it, we talk a lot about Wizard and Glass being the best written of all the Dark Tower books, and I think that's kind of hard to argue against. It's not my favorite of them, but there's something about the way he's writing this, and like you said, all the flavors of the sweeping romance and the fantasy and all that is just gelling together in such a way that, like, I think it's one of the best things that he's ever written, to be honest. But I think it's one of the best written of the Dark Towers. And the example I always use when I talk about this is that going in that Susan's not going to make it out of the story. We've known that for three books at this point. But there comes a point while reading this where he kind of convinces you, just as Roland is convinced, that they won. Like, it feels like if it was going to happen, it was going to happen at a certain moment, and the young gunslingers are victorious, and all the bad guys are on their back foot, and you're like, this is great. We won. They're going to somehow make it out of this, and then they don't. We couldn't do this final episode of 2025 without our longest sponsor. That's right, the good folks at Lumi Labs, the folks behind the best gummies on the market. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Labs has a strain that's right for you. Yesterday, I gotta say, was a rough one for me. You don't want to hear my problems. I'm not going to burden you with that. But suffice it to say, it's your typical end-of-the-year stress shit. So I spent the day dealing with all that, and when it came time to unwind,
Guess what I did? I popped a couple of Lumi Sativa D9 gummies and was finally able to relax, and I fell asleep like a baby in a crib. Let me tell you what. Lumi gummies come in sativa, indica, and hybrid style, so however you want to take the edge off or get a relaxed creative boost, they have an option for you. And they all taste good, which is something that you don't often get with edibles. Lumi gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com, that's lumigummies.com, and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off of your order. Again, that's lumigummies.com, code KINGCAST. LumiGummies.com, code KINGCAST. Now let's get back to the show.
She's such a beautifully drawn character, yeah. Susan Delgado. Like, she's beautiful and alluring, but she's kind, she's strong, she's tough. Like, she's the whole package.
Well, and she's got such agency about her, too. Like, yeah. She's even from that first scene where she's with Rhea. You know, and she's totally violated, you know, by her. Like, there's still, yeah, you're right. There's like a strength about her that I think this could very much have become a damsel in distress, mm-hmm. you know, thing. But I mean, there's that whole sequence towards the end where she basically goes in and saves all the guys from, you know, from the jail. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not a girl to be trifled with, you know?
No, like, she's quite a person, quite a woman. Like, I think it's easy to swoon for her, like, mm-hmm. As a reader, to really fall in love with this character and then to have her taken away so brutally it's hard. I think King really makes you feel what Roland feels for her. You know, that there's a deep attraction there. This isn't just a fling or, hey, I'm a rough and tumble guy visiting to negotiate some oil trade. Like, and you're the beautiful concubine who's going to have to marry this old bastard. Like, it's a deeper relationship than that. And she's so enchanting. I really think it is a extremely well-written, well-characterized book. Mm-hmm. Characters are his superpower, yeah. And I think he really is in full form here. I mean, I'm looking at my copy. I think it was not in hardback, right? It was always in trade paperback. Isn't it way?
They released it as hardback through Grant. And I remember that, you know, because Grant is the publisher, the limited publisher, mm-hmm. the small publisher that put out the very first Gunslinger. And for the first, you know, I don't know, God, for the first bit, like, you could only get the Gunslinger if you got one of these, like, limited to 1700 copies thing. And I mean, he tells a story about how you know, one of his books, maybe his Pet Cemetery or something, where they have the also by this author, and they list like all the other books by him. Mm-hmm. That was the first time the Gunslinger was put on there, and he said that like his office got inundated, going, where is this? It's like, I can't just go to the bookstore and find this. This isn't in paperback. Yeah. And so for the first three, you could only really get them through these limited press, and then they put them all out. I think it was Plume, right? Put out mm-hmm. all the soft cover versions, brought all the great art from the series in as well. And I think you're right. I think that with Wizard and Glass, for the mass market, it was always in the paperback form. I mean, I have a hardback, but I was collecting the Grant books even at that
but time. I was just struck by his author photo. Look at this young, fresh fellow here.
Look at that guy.
Like, you know, I'm used to seeing him either with like the big woolly beard, like the backwoods mm-hmm. madman, or seeing him now, you know, older, distinguished gentleman. But yeah, here he is, Simon and Garfunkel, bookends.
There he is.
Yeah.
There he is. Just a floating head in the black.
Floating head in the black. You know, with a very serious author face. But I'm with you, Eric. And Graham, I don't know if you agree, but I think this is the best written of the books.
And Eric, I agree with something you said, too. Like, I don't know that this is necessarily my favorite, like, in terms mm-hmm. of the book that, you know, I think it's probably The Wastelands, because mm-hmm. that is the most action-packed. It's the most, like, you know, sci-fi, fantasy kind of whatever, you know. But this one is the one out of all these books that emotionally affects me the most.
Yeah.
And you know, and Anthony, to speak to something you said, like the fact that we spend so much time with Susan getting to know her, like that's why this flashback needs to be the majority of a whole book. Like it wouldn't work otherwise for Roland to spend.
Yeah. There's no shortcut to that.
Yeah. You know? Like in a few chapters, there's no way that he could fully, get through like what exactly she means and make us as readers care as much as we do, by the end of this, you know, and like, oh my God, like as the flames are coming up there, I reread the section, the whole Charyu tree section, and you know, and it says something like she feels heat but not pain, and she's looking up at the reaping moon, I guess, and is you know, she shouts, "I love thee, Roland," and it's like such, I get choked up even just thinking about it, you know, and you're like, you've spent all this time, like you said, Anthony, hoping, like maybe this time it'll be okay, you know, and even having read this book a number of times, it's like every time you're just going, oh man, I hope it's different, which weirdly fits into the whole Dark Tower thing, you know, this whole cyclical, is it going to be different this time?
The wheel goes round again and
Wheel
around
goes round and
again.
round,
But
yeah.
even that concept was still, he talked about the wheel a lot, that this, the world is, life is a wheel. It always comes around to the same place again.
Yeah.
But the notion that actually we're on a loop, that this whole world is on a loop, is, that comes later, I think.
Oh yeah, well yeah, and not until the final pages of the
Not
last
until,
book,
yeah, the final
yeah.
book. He's what is it,
That's
like
right. Is
Roland looks
that
on.
how? Well,
Yeah, well, it's like he walks in and he looks on with
spoilers, of
horror.
course, but this isn't the Dark Tower episode to listen to for no spoilers. So, but yes.
But yeah, it's like it's, and I love that. I love that, you know, it also kind of makes you wonder, because I've always felt like the first three books kind of, it felt a little bit like he was getting more ideas and adding them and just building a cool story. And then with this one, things started to gel, you know, like the greater arc. And I don't know if that's true. I don't know if in interviews and stuff he said
Oh,
otherwise.
I think it's definitely true, right? Because he even goes back and does a George Lucas and revises the Gunslinger a little to just sort of help it fit a little more.
Going from this well, and I mean, that's what makes Wizard and Glass kind of special, because I view the first three books as their own, like, you know, era of Dark Tower, right? And maybe it's all nostalgia, because that's, you know, I read them back to back to back, right? And they're each different genres. The first one's, you know, predominantly like the psychedelic Western, you know, it's a little Jodorowsky a bit, right? It's but it's the predominant flavor is Western. The second one, the predominant flavor is like science fiction, because you have portals that lead to different times, and you know, people pulling different people out of different timelines and whatnot. And then the third one, like you said, is like kind of that fantasy adventure. It's like this, you know, it's almost like it's
Empire
England,
Strikes Back is a good
you know. Yeah, it's a
comparison, like
great,
you
yeah, it's a
said.
great analog, yeah.
And then this one is its own. This one, to me, out of all the one out of all the books, this feels like an island in and of itself. But it's also the thing that kind of marries that first era and then books five, six, and seven, which all feel, you know, akin to one another. You know, the predominant flavor of book five, of course, is the Kurosawa, you know, Seven Samurai slash Magnificent Seven version of it in this world. But there's not, you like you said, the overall, you know, arc is established in Wizard and Glass, and then five, six, and seven are all one long continuous story. You know, the series gets convoluted. It gets weird. It gets some shit starts not adding up. There's a few things in there that I wished, as looking back on it, like I never would have said this at the time, because all I wanted was to finish the series. I wanted to get to the end of the Dark Tower, finish it out. But it makes me wish that he hadn't pumped them all out at once. I kind of wish that he had done Wolves of the Kala, taken his break, and then Song of Susanna would have had a different feel to it, and then Dark Tower would have a different feel, because you know, you get, when you're rushing in through the back half of something that had taken you 20 plus years at this point to get up to, you know, they lose the books lose their own individual identities to me a little bit, and then you start getting these painted into a corner things, and maybe it was always inevitable, but like that's why you have to introduce a character that can literally just erase the bad guy if need be, or you know, you introduce these all powerful characters and all powerful concepts at the very end, and that's kind of like introducing a murder, having a murder mystery and having all the suspects, and then at the very last page it's like, oh, and then this was just a guy that was hiding in the closet the whole time or whatever, and you couldn't have guessed it. There's a few a few things that don't add up, but even saying all that, I still think that the whole core concept of how he ends the series is a fucking miracle to me. And
yeah,
and I know that it pisses some people off, and but like to me, it just makes everything that much more of a gut punch, and makes it you know, it pays off, you know, this thing where I don't think it's very clear that whether or not the world is on repeat or if it's just Roland. I think it's just Roland.
I think it's just Roland.
Roland
yeah.
himself is doomed until he does the right combination of things to be stuck in this cycle. And that's just, you know, it's mythological.
Stephen King's Groundhog Day.
Well, a little bit. It's mythological. It's, you know, mm-hmm. he's Sisyphus, right? It's like mm-hmm. he's, you know, yeah. You get this thing where, like, but there's also hope to it. And I love that it's not a Twilight Zone ending where it's like, and he's fucked for all time or whatever. You know, the fact that he comes back with the Horn of Eld, this, you know, this tool that was lost, this artifact that was lost in the Battle of Jericho Hill, and what could possibly be different, but the fact is there is something different this time. And is this so, and I love the fact that we got the story when you're looking at it where this isn't the end of the story. There he could do, you know, 1,000 more cycles. This could be the one that changes, and that hope that, you know, that's there, I think people ignore. And I've said about, I don't know, three college course lectures worth of concepts on how incredible the Dark Tower is in my well, little rant there.
But, in terms of like changing things up as he goes, don't you get the sense that he, when he was finishing The Wastelands, that he had this idea of like, the big bad of this world is going to be TikTok Man. Hmm. He's going to be my villainous figure. Yeah. And then when he got into Wizard and Glass, he realized, I think that's maybe where the multi-level, like, maybe this connects to all my worlds. Hey, maybe Randall Flagg could be the big bad, or maybe he's the Darth Vader who has an even worse boss. Yeah. You know,
well it sort of feels to me like he discovered in writing Wizard and Glass that this kind of meta understanding of the tropes, you know, mm-hmm. this is already a series that was rooted in tropes, right? It's about right. it's Clint Eastwood, it's the man mm-hmm. with no name. And that's sort of plainly there, you know, like we know that we're dealing with an archetype. And I think that it's this book where, yeah, it's exactly that, where he's got, you know, he's already had the TikTok Man. He's already had, you know, Martin Broadcloak. He's had the Man in Black. And he's going, oh, well, I had the Walking Dude, you know, and I've got all these characters. And all of literature has these characters that are, you know, the dude that we're all afraid of. Mm-hmm. What if it's all the same guy? Mm-hmm. And I find that, and I think that this is the one where he kind of sticks with that to the point where he goes to, you know, one, I mean, maybe the most iconic version of him in all of literature and film, which is the Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this big terrifying, and he's literally a wizard, you know, and that's where it all like ties together. And I've talked to some people that think the ending of this book with the whole Wizard of Oz thing is a little goofy and a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's like where King really kind of settles into the crux of what the Dark Tower overall like means. Right. And yeah, I mean, I'll agree that I think Wolves of the Cala and Song of Susanna, with King himself being a character, again, spoiler alert, you know, mm-hmm. but all that stuff, it gets a little wonky. But man, Eric, I agree with you. I think that once we get to the end and we see how he really does pull it all together, mm-hmm. I think he totally sticks the landing on this series, which I frankly didn't expect him to do, because I don't think King always does stick the landing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of notorious for it. And I agree to a point. I think that the, you know, well, here's the thing is I agree completely with the answering the question, what is on the top floor of the Dark Tower?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that is like, and it goes back to the metaphysical shit from the beginning of the story, from the very beginning, his meeting with the Man in Black, you know, where ages and eons pass after, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like, you know, all that shit kind of, it fits. I think that the problem is that you are forced to fall in love with this quartet, right? Mm-hmm. Wastelands, you know, the reason why I like it so much is it's them working together. Wolves of the Kala, you know, the strongest parts of that book are you see this finely, you know, oiled and well-maintained machine of a group working together, and you love each one of them. They each have a role. and then, you know, but the ultimate story has to be Roland, you know, be getting all that taken away from him, which makes for kind of a depressing read. But also, you know, I do wish that we would get a moment, you know, where I would have loved to have seen all the quartet in that rose field and what that showdown would have been. Yeah. Right. And you know, but I understand that's not the story, but maybe that is the story later on. You know, I mean, that's
how I feel about it.
Which is interesting. Yeah. And I would love to. And, you know, people ask all the time. We do these mailbag episodes for the Patreon. Mm-hmm. And one of the most commonly asked questions, you know, kind of boils down to, like, you know, what would you want another Dark Tower book to be? Like, would you want a book from King? And, you know, he said in the past that he feels drawn to Jericho Hill. And I'm like, that would be a great standalone Stephen King story where you see the fall of Gilead, you see the end of the Gunslingers, essentially, and what happened in that battle, which is only mentioned. We know that it's the end. We don't know anything else about it, right? That's great. But what I would love to see him do, if he decided to go back in the Dark Tower world, is to write the next turn at the wheel, and maybe it's only one novel, right? Maybe he gets there, you know, when Roland has the Horn of Eld, and, you know, I think that they mention, you know, pretty explicitly in the book that Roland always fails on this quest when he lets Jake drop. So what happens when he doesn't? Does that, like, shortcut him, essentially, you know, past a lot of the heartache part of it? Like, you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, how, you know, how does he draw the quartet, you know, without needing to pull Jake? You know, it's like, you know, all this stuff, it's like, to me, that would be the most interesting, like, Dark Tower revisit, is like the next turn of the wheel. You know, what does it look like, if Roland succeeds? But then again, then you're also like, you know, do you want to, you know, tie off the story with a, you know, a perfect bow ending? It's like, that wouldn't feel right either. So I don't know, but I would love to see him revisit these characters. I think a lot of that's just me being very selfish, because he writes these characters so well. And especially when, you know, he kind of came back with Wind Through the Keyhole, which is like kind of the black sheep of the Dark Tower, you know, books, because it's not really a Dark Tower book. It's not really a short story book. It's more Roland. It's a lot like Wizard and Glass, where it's Roland sitting around a campfire telling his quartet of, you know, his childhood fairy tale stories, right?
Yeah.
But you even, you know, getting that, you get that little slice, because it takes place in between Wizard and Glass and Wolves of the Kala, and you get those characters interacting again together. And I, like, he slips into it so well, and I'm like, I just want to see more of those guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, together. So.
Yeah.
So there we go. Yet another soapbox rant from me. You're welcome.
What do you think about the TikTok man getting just iced so quickly? Like, again, he's set up. Are you with me on the theory that King was like, I actually don't need this guy. I got bigger fish to fry. And we're just going to, because he's set up as this sort of Mad Max type of villain, right? The TikTok man is straight out of Fury Road. Mm-hmm. You know, a generation later. Mm-hmm. And he just sort of whacks him. It reminds me of the Godfather, you know, hey, where's Polly? Oh, Polly, won't see him no more. <You know? laughs> Yeah. TikTok man, oh, don't worry about him, you won't see him no more.
Oh, I mean, for sure, once you have Randall Flagg in the equation, then, you know, he just smartly saw there's no need for him, and mm-hmm. you know, but you're right, it does feel like he's built up this character all through the Wastelands. Of, you know, you see these little hints of the plane you mentioned, and then you get the backstory. This is a leader of one of the fucking roving gangs of pirates in the city, and mm-hmm. all this stuff. And yeah, you do get this feeling like he's meant for more, but that's also what you get a lot later. I mean, Randall Flagg, you know, you get that same feeling once you finish the Dark Tower. It's right. Like, you know, it does feel like Randall Flagg is also kind of cast aside for this other greater threat that Roland doesn't even fucking end up dealing with, yeah. Which is one of my issues with the Crimson King as a bad guy, because he's built up as one thing, and then, you know, a lot of it's about, you know, expectation too, though. Yeah. I like, you know, you build up this big evil man, you know, that has all this control and this power, and he's actually, you know, in the Dark Tower, and he's gonna fucking destroy it from within, and like, you got to stop him. He's breaking the beams and all this shit, and then you get there, and he's just a fucking crazy old dude on a fucking balcony. It's like, you know, to a degree, that's pretty fucking baller move to pull, but you know, but in order to get there and to build that guy up, you're also kind of cutting out the, you know, or prematurely ending maybe the Randall Flagg story.
Well, I just wondered with TikTok Man too, if it was like, is that a utilitarian death, or is that a is that actually a literary device where you have this big monster and then wait, there's a bigger monster right behind him, you know?
There's always a bigger fish.
Always a bigger fish. Another Phantom Menace prophetic moment from Stephen King.
Do y'all think that the that Stephen King based the TikTok Man on the Harlan Ellison villain from Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok Man? Do y'all know that story?
I don't, but it wouldn't surprise me in the least if he did.
Yeah, it's a Harlan Ellison story. It's from the 60s, I think, and it's basically about there's the TikTok Man who sort of in like a Metropolis kind of way, like rules over this world with like all these mechanical stuff. And then somebody, you know, tries to, you know, rebel against him. The Harlequin, you know, is trying to rebel against him. And so I wonder if he took inspiration from that, because it's all pretty similar. I just not thought of that.
Yeah, that'd be likely. It's possible. Know he's talked about Harlan's work in the past. So
yeah.
Yeah. The very famously cantankerous Harlan Ellison, ladies and gentlemen. I have a great Harlan Ellison story, but it would take another 15 minutes, and I don't want to do this. So put a pin in that one. I've told it a couple of times on the show, but we'll you know, I think we should start gearing down. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Any other angle on this? The only thing that kind of jumps to my mind is I'd like to, you know, kind of give King his flowers a little bit for making us fall in love with the Eddie, Jake, Susanna, Oi, Quartet. Yeah. And then you're like, fuck, I have to, you know, like, I want to be with those people. Those are the people I like. And then also then he makes us fall in love with his younger Quartet. And he very smartly makes parallels between them, because you hear throughout the books up to this point that Roland goes, what Eddie just did reminded me of, you know,
Cuthbert,
Cuthbert, I don't know,
Cuthbert, it is,
you know, and you know, Elaine has a lot of qualities of, you know, Suzanne, like all this stuff. I love seeing the parallels and all that stuff, but maybe we can talk a little bit about the the young Quartet.
I mean, those guys, I love them. I think that I think the parallels are absolutely there. I love that Roland was like the serious one from the very beginning. You know, Roland's always kind of, he's like that very serious kind of goth kid that, like, you know, doesn't laugh at anything and is all,
he's got big feelings.
Yeah, he's got big feelings. and I like how the three of them work together. You know, I think my favorite of them honestly is Cuthbert. I just say Cuthbert. I don't know. Again, I haven't listened to the audiobook, so I don't know. But like with Cuthbert, I love how he's always joking, but when he needs to get serious, he gets serious. You know, and I love how both Elaine and Cuthbert are like true blue friends. And I think one of the things that this book really like kind of shows is that Roland's the one that, like, he's loyal and he's devoted, but man, he'll give you up if there's something else that he wants.
Yeah.
And at
the
first,
seeds of letting Jake drop are definitely
it's
shown
absolutely
here.
There, you know, and at first it's, you know, he goes for the girl, he goes for Susan, and then he sort of gives her up too, because he sees the tower and he wants the tower. And even the stuff with the Horn of Eld that we've talked about, you know, all that stuff is wrapped up in, I mean, he talks about how that's when Cuthbert died. You know, and you wonder, like, you know, what did really happen? Did he also sacrifice them in service of something? Is that what this whole wheel thing is about? Is and I fully agree with you. I think that it all goes back to not letting Jake drop. You know, it's about Roland learning the true value of friendship and the true value of what a quartet actually means.
Yeah.
It's not a group that's going to help you achieve your goal. It's we're all in this together. And he, it seems like he keeps getting so close to that, to like really getting it. And still, he always ends up kind of fucking it up. And I think that with seeing Elaine and Cuthbert and how they are, man, they are with Roland, and they are as goofy as they get, and as fucked up as everything gets in this story, they're right by his side all the time. You know, including there's a beautiful scene towards the end where, you know, I think it's Elaine just lays his hand on Roland's cheek when he can't pry him away from the grapefruit. You know, and he just sits there and rests his hand on his cheek, like, I'm here with you, pal. Like, I'm here with you. And it's just part of that whole tragic cycle for Roland. He just can't seem to always see that.
Such a great character, such, you know, such a great book to like give that character even more depth. So, Graham, thank you so much for joining us here
Yeah.
and
Thank y'all. I'm
chatting Wizard and
thrilled.
Glass with us.
Yeah. Yeah, if there's anything that anybody could take away from this, it's like give The Dark Tower a shot. I know it's seven books. I know it's a lot of pages. I know some people aren't as much into fantasy stuff, but it's really good.
It's
Like
very good.
start to finish, even the, you know, so-called weaker entries, it all is in service of the beam. It's all in service of the tower, and it's one of my favorite book series of all time.
If Steve had only written this, man, he'd be a legend just for that. And then
Yeah.
all the other books on top of it. So, you know, yeah, this is, I'm with you. I'm with
Yep,
you. It's a
I
good one.
agree. Yeah, even when it gets sloppy, you're so pot committed at that point, man. It's like you just love the characters, and it could be the literally the worst book you've ever read, and it would still be better than most
Yeah.
books just
Yeah.
because you're invested in the characters and you love them.
Yeah,
So,
100%.
thank you guys so much. I always love jumping into Dark Tower nerdiness, and this was a particularly fun chat. So thank you all.
It's a
Yeah,
great
thank y'all
one.
very much.
Many thanks to Graham Skipper for joining us for some Dark Tower chat to wrap up the year. I also, little peek behind the KingCast curtain here, I have to apologize to Graham for taking so damn long to release this episode. We recorded this a long time ago, and poor Graham kept getting bumped as we got in new recordings that had to go up at certain times. But we got him in at the very end of the year, and I think that this officially makes Graham the KingCast's Matt Damon, does it not? Well, I guess the difference is we actually put him on the show, unlike that dastardly Jimmy Kimmel. So thanks again for your patience, Graham. As you guys can tell, it was a banger of a chat. We had a lot of fun talking with him, a lot of fun diving back into the world of the Dark Tower, and I'm sure that won't be the last time you hear us talking about Midworld as we go into the year 2026. As usual, if you dig the show and want to support it, you have a couple of options here. One is easy and free. Just tell a friend or chat about us on your favorite social media platform of choice. Spread the gospel of the KingCast, my children. That is option one. The other way to support it and my preferred way is you throw us a few bucks a month over at Patreon. And if you do, you're going to get instant access to over 5 years worth of bonus episodes, including our legendary RPG show, Shelbyville, with me, Wampler, Mallory O'Mara, and our great GM, Jacob Hall. We have commentaries. You'll get access to our Discord. We have a great community over there. So feel free to join us. Head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. And that about wraps up the year, does it not? It's been a pretty great year for us, I think. You know, this is our first full year with me and Brez behind the wheel. And I don't know about you guys, but I've been very happy with the quality of guests we've gotten. I think the show's doing pretty well. I'm loving the dynamic Brez is bringing to it. I look forward to continuing that in the year 2026. We are, as of this posting, hours away from a brand new year. It certainly can't be any worse than this one, right? Thank you for joining along, and we will see you next year. Adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself, as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.